This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The focus of the European migrant crisis has shifted. So far this year, nearly 100,000 people have set off from Libya and travelled in small boats to Italy. More than 2,000 have died. Italy say they've had enough.
We can't cope anymore. The ports will be overwhelmed very quickly. We receive nearly 600,000 people over 3 years. It's like the population of Manchester, all to Italy.
It seems that the situation is unsustainable. But who's coming? Where from? Why? And are we just flailing around, or has someone got a plan? Step inside the briefing room to find out from the people who know. The journey people undertake across the Mediterranean is usually tough and sometimes tragic. Why do the migrants themselves say they take such risks?
I'm from Nigeria, so I left my country because I need a better life.
It is not easy for us to be here today because in that boat many people died, but God still keep us alive.
I'm from Nigeria. On my journey, I faced so many difficulties through the desert, through the sea, in Libya, many difficulties, many things happen, many tribulations.
Because of the suffering in Africa, Nigeria, we believe that Europe is better, so some of us are not afraid of death.
The first thing we need to know is who the migrants are and where they come from. In the briefing room to tell me that is Joel Millman from the UN's International Organization for Migration. Joel, tell me exactly that.
Well, they almost entirely come from sub-Saharan Africa, Western Africa. We've seen a drop in Horn of Africa people that used to be quite prevalent on this route, but they've been replaced almost entirely by people in the West African littoral and around the desert area, with a couple of crucial exceptions, one of them being Bangladeshis, who have risen to the second place among most people coming to Italy from Libya. They're up to 8,300 right now. That's more than the total of all last year. We're not entirely sure why there's such a surge, but they really do stand out as the non-African group.
Bangladesh, that's going to be a bit of a surprise to everybody. It's a surprise to me. Bangladesh is a long way from Libya, and it seems an odd thing for Bangladeshis to want to cross the Mediterranean. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there's something that you're overlooking when you say it's odd for Libya. There is an enormous Bangladeshi population there historically because Muslim countries that rely on petro-immigrants, let's say, people serve the large petro-economies of the Gulf, of the Emirates, of the oil-exporting countries, of which Libya historically has been one. tend to rely on a lot of people from South Asia, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh, even from as far away as Indonesia. So it's not that unusual because there were so many Bangladeshis in the country at the time of Gaddafi's death 6 years ago. We evacuated 200,000 people from boats right in 2011, and many of them were Bangladeshis. So what we're seeing now, we estimate about a half are long-termers, people that probably were there before Gaddafi died, who've toughed it out any way they can in the oil fields, tried to stay safe as best they could, and have finally grown fed up with the violence and have to leave. And that we've heard that from a lot of different nationalities. But what is strange is the other half do appear to be spending less than a year in Libya, sometimes less than 6 months, and are absolutely involved with smuggling organizations that are forging documents and sending them through either Istanbul or Dubai on commercial flights directly to Tripoli. And they are finding the going much tougher than they expected in Libya, and they are the ones showing up on boats arriving in Italy. We understand there's approximately 143,000 Bangladeshis in Italy now, and this is a growing colony of menial labor people, farm worker people, young entrepreneurs. You're seeing all kinds of growing a colony of Bangladeshis in Italy.
Now, what about the Nigerians? I mean, you've said, obviously, it's a large country and it's actually been higher, but I don't think it's generally known that Nigerians cross the Mediterranean. I mean, I suppose it's generally thought they have other ways of getting to various places. Why are they leaving Nigeria?
That's a good question, because we know the displacement from things like Boko Haram and the violence in the Lake Chad Basin. We're not seeing that much of a spillover into Libya from that part of Nigeria. What we are seeing is heavy traffic, 14,000 people, we understand, mostly young women from the south, from the Delta states and Edo state in southern Nigeria.
Mostly young women?
Yes, and many of them being forced into prostitution. It doesn't seem to fit the displacement through violence or forced migration model that we associate with other parts of Nigeria. Nigeria is just so big, its numbers tend to dominate almost every scenario you can think of. And yes, there are thousands who manage to get to Europe with papers legally, long-term stayers, you know, students, businessmen. They come from a pretty wealthy country by African standards. And that's another thing that you should point out in any migration stories. It's not usually the poorest of the poor that make these long trips. We call them the poorest of the rich, or the poorest of the moneyed classes, those access to education, pretty good jobs. Sometimes they own their own businesses, but they're just not satisfied enough, and they want to gamble what they have on a much better future. And those are the ones you often see making these journeys.
It's a hell of a gamble if you do have something, i.e. not absolutely nothing, to go to Libya and then cross the Mediterranean.
Oh, there's no question that it is. But on the other hand, the statistics that were borne out the last 3 years are pretty much a 95 to 98% success rate. I mean, thousands of people are dying every year on these trips, but hundreds of thousands are making the crossings. So you have to judge for yourself. But most people that we survey say the odds are good. They have so many acquaintances, members of their own families have already made these trips. There's also a kind of fatalistic attitude that God will take me when he wants to take me. And so it's out of my hands. I could drown at sea, or I could get hit by a car here in Ghana or someplace. So you hear that awful lot. And so that kind of mitigates the fear factor.
Joel Millman, thank you. So most of those crossing to Italy haven't fled war in their home country and wouldn't be granted asylum on that basis, nor are they mostly destitute. The majority left their homes in search of work and a better life, whatever they had to go through to get there.
Yeah, this journey was such a terrible and disastrous journey. 7 kids died, the mother, pregnant women, died. All I have to say is to advise my rest that are about to come, because I know they are about to come travelers. My advice to them is that they shouldn't risk their life in search of going to Italy. Let me say some, because of our greed, want to make money in abundance, want to be stinking rich. I don't see anything there. What I saw yesterday was such a terrible one. I thank God that I made it.
But how do these migrants get from their home countries to Libya and then to Italy? Joining us in the briefing room from the BBC's Beirut studio is Tuesday Reitano, who monitors smuggling networks across Africa. Tuesday Reitano, describe the journey to me.
Not every journey is the same for every person, but essentially it usually starts in the same way. They've expressed a desire, there's an opportunity to move elsewhere, so they've started their journey looking for a local migration broker. These are not hard to find. So they'll start their journey seeking out their local migration broker, talking to them about where they want to go, how they want to get there, almost what deals and offers there are in place. And that will depend on what the migration broker has in terms of other people looking to move or what connections they have to help them.
You make the migration broker, we'll come to in a moment, sound like a travel agent. You know, you want to go somewhere or you just want to go. You find this person and they then give you a range of options.
That's pretty much how it works. That's what smugglers are in the majority, vast majority of contexts. The situation in Libya is a little bit different because of the way that the market has accelerated. But 99% of migration brokers across the planet, and this is not Africa specific, are essentially travel agents for irregular and illegal migration. And often some do both jobs. They'll be travel agents by day and smugglers by night.
Okay, so let's go into that. I am in Lagos. I contact the migration broker. And what does the migration broker say to me?
He'll ask you how much money you've got first, usually. So at the very highest end, for several thousand dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, you'll get a full package with accommodation, plane tickets, fraudulent visas, sometimes even legitimate visas, help to find a job, a place to land, and somebody to smooth your passage the entire way. If you only have a couple of $100, you'll be told, buy a bus ticket to here, get off there, contact this guy, pay this much in bribes, go to the next place, try and aim to get to, usually it's the far reaches of your legal travel zone, and that's where you'll meet my cousin so-and-so, and he'll take you the rest of the way.
So take me through a typical journey then at the bottom end of the scale.
Either they'll go on a bus or a small rented van up until the point where they reach a physical obstacle they can't cross or a border that they can't cross by themselves. It's at that point that the real smuggling journey begins. And for people moving out of West Africa, that's as they reach the northern end of the ECOWAS zone. So up until Niger, they are free to move almost entirely at their own volition. Once they want to get out of Niger and up into Algeria or into Libya, there they're talking about quite seriously restrictive border controls. They're talking about insecurity. So in periods where there are conflicts going on, localized conflicts, that's when smugglers begin to develop because they're helping people to navigate through the difficult territory. Or when they get to a major physical landmark that isn't easy to cross. So the Sahara Desert being obviously the most significant in sub-Saharan Africa.
So I've got up to that point. I've got up to the point of a difficult border, or I've got up to the point of the Sahara. What happens to me?
You'll have turned up in a classic smuggling hub, and there you will find hundreds of people ready to offer you smuggling services. I mean, they swarm around like they were offering a taxi ride, you know, asking you here, you want to go? Do you want to go to Europe? Are you trying to get to Libya? Come here. For me, it's $50. I've got a transit leaving tomorrow. You come and ask me, brother. You ask me, cousin. I'll help you. I'm safe. I'm reliable. And if you haven't already been given a number or someone to contact, you'll pick up somebody there that seems to be offering a good deal. And it's that point now, at least in the contemporary migration environment, that pretty much the migrant loses any control over the rest of their journey.
So they get across the border into Libya, and then what?
Well, it's not so easy. You make it sound easy. It's not so easy. Often the amount of money that they'll be asked to pay in Agadez or in the northern cities at the brink of the Sahara will be more than they have. They'll pay a down payment or a small initial fee, and then they'll be held by their smuggler, who is waiting to achieve a critical mass of migrants before they themselves can move people on. We talk a lot about smuggling networks being consolidated as if they're one organized group, but actually for the front man, the recruitment broker, the one who deals with migrants on a one-to-one basis, they are seldom actually part of an organized hierarchy. What they have to do is bring clients, and the smuggling networks usually want them in groups. And then that specific broker will not be able to move his group on until he has the agreed number. It's usually between 20 and 50. And the problem for the migrant is if you are one of the first to enter the arrangement with this particular migrant broker, you'll wait the longest. And in the period of waiting, often the brokers will farm their migrants out to earn their keep. So any broker who's holding people has to keep them secure. They'll need a local security guard with a gun. They'll have to feed them, probably not very much. But over and all, they have to keep their charges under control. So they'll offer them as small work gangs, for example, to try and earn the money for their onward passage.
Right. And next?
Across the Sahara, broadly, there are two or three nomadic groups who have crossed the Sahara for generations who would be able to facilitate that journey. They have invested in what we would call the smuggling infrastructure, the trucks, the cars, the GPS systems, the certain location points where they would store water reserves or fuel reserves that will allow them to make the anywhere between 3 and 7 day journey across the desert, arriving at one of the southern Libyan towns at the end of their journey.
So there they are in the southern Libyan town. What then?
Basically, once they've reached southern Libya, the sub-Saharan African nomadic groups that have been moving them will pass them on to Libyan groups. But at this point, there's very little control for them. The individual migrant will be moved according to the whims of their smugglers. Many in the southern Libyan desert and also now moving up towards the coast will be held in very large detention centers, either official detention centers or militia-run detention centers, until the next leg of their passage is arranged. There is an increasing practice now that the groups that are holding people will try and extort migrants for more money. So we have heard a number of reports from migrants who have crossed the desert and as well as from our own monitoring that migrants are being beaten and abused and being told to call their families for additional money if they want to be released.
And then what happens?
And then what happens is those that are extorted will pay at some stage, or they could stay there for a year or more.
For a year or more?
Yes. There are certainly cases of people who have been held for a year or more in detention centres waiting for a payment that would allow them to be released. Again, they will see this practice that they'll be farmed out for forced labour with local construction sites, for example, or local agricultural work. One very stark example in the recent UN report talked about migrant workers groups who were sent out to clear landmines in mined areas of southeastern Libya near the border with Chad. So really, the migrants are commodities. They're put to work to earn their keep until they continue their journey.
Let's do the last leg. How do they get over to Italy?
Each individual rubber dinghy or small wooden boat is carrying upwards of 150 people. In recent months, we have increasingly seen boats being sent out to sea without an engine. Because the engine is the most valuable part of the boat, and now they're using rubber dinghies, which they don't expect necessarily to recover, then they'll have one boat which will drag the migrant boat out into the sea, essentially push them in the direction with the current. And one member of the boat will have been given a small cell phone or a small sat phone and been told, float for 2 hours and then call this number and somebody will come and rescue you.
Now, we tend to make a distinction between people moving voluntarily and people being trafficked, but the picture that you've depicted so far is of a strange kind of combination of voluntary movement and being trafficked.
It is exactly that, and which is why this distinction has become so hard to make. People are on a voluntary journey that they will almost certainly end up at their agreed destination at the end, and that they will be free at the end of their journey. And for us, then, that is smuggling. But they will be subject to aggravated abuse and periods where they are not free to make choices about what is done to them or where they go. And that is the difficult part, where it very much sounds like human trafficking. But the point is that they are still on a consensual journey with their smugglers. And I think what is almost more disturbing is that they often know the risks. They're very aware, and that they plan for them accordingly. So we've sat in communities in Eastern Africa, for example, and they say, well, we know that when we cross this part of the desert, the chances of being picked up by a kidnapping group are very high. Usually you can get out for between $500 to $800. So we've factored that into the costs of the journey. We now have enough to go. Similar stories we've heard from women. Rape is very common, extremely common. I mean, a vulnerable woman alone, it's not even a systematic practice. It's just part of the journey. So they start planning to take oral contraceptives before they begin their journey to avoid getting pregnant.
What you've described, the whole process that you've described, sounds as if it's a kind of hydra-headed monster. In other words, if you were to cut off, it's so organic that if you were to cut off one head or one root of this, then it would simply grow back somewhere else. Or is that wrong?
I think that the only head that really matters at this point, the only one that would really make a difference, is Libya. All of the others, whether you close down Niger routes, whether you manage to increase border control in Algeria, whether you can strengthen Tunisia and Algeria's seacoast or Egypt's seacoast, won't have the impact. It is Libya that has become the big hole in the dam that all the water is washing through.
Cesare Reitano, thank you. Wherever they come from and however they get there, Italy is where they're ending up. Joining me now in the briefing room is an expert on Italian politics and society, Mattia Toaldo, from the think tank the European Council on Foreign Relations. Mattia Toaldo, how are ordinary Italians feeling now about this crisis?
There has been a shift in public opinion against migrants recently, just because the number has been so high. There has been a strain on some city councils. And I think most importantly, there is the idea that the situation is out of control.
How do people experience themselves that out of controlness, or is it just something they see in their newspapers?
It's not just in the newspapers anymore. What happens, especially in train stations or in public spaces, is that you see a lot of undocumented people who basically have no hope of being able to do anything or to move around, who are just hanging there. Basically, you have a significant increase of the homeless.
And what kind of people are these homeless? Do people feel threatened by them?
Of course, there is a sense of insecurity. You have a lot of strangers around. They're mostly Africans. There is the idea that this is also a Muslim invasion, which, of course, is not the case. And so there is an idea that this is connected to the development of terrorism, which, of course, so far has not been the case.
How is that worry amongst ordinary Italians making itself felt politically?
In recent local elections, basically every single mayor who had accepted migrants on its territory has lost his seat.
How much of the politics is turned towards demanding that other countries help the Italians through this problem?
I would say 80% of the public discourse is devoted to this part of the conversation rather than what can we do to manage it. One part of the conversation is what can we ask Libya to do for us so that migrants don't come here? And another part of the conversation is we have been left alone by Europe. And this is partially true because Italy was just a transit country. Bear in mind that, for instance, still in 2014, only one third of the flow applied for asylum in Italy. This number has doubled last year. And as I said, the numbers in 2017 are incredible. This has happened because the borders with Austria and France have now become more hostile, let's say, to migrants. So if a migrant before landed in Sicily and then could make his way up to Sweden in some cases through Austria or France, they now have to stay in Italy. So this idea that we now get all the burden and the other Europeans are not doing anything for us while we're paying into the EU budget, which is then spent in roads in Eastern Europe, is making its way into Italian public opinion in a very strong way.
Italy is calling on the EU for help. We've been here before. The other route into the EU from Turkey has largely been closed thanks to a deal in which people arriving in Greece are expected to be sent back to Turkey to apply for asylum there. So what might work to stop the disruption and the suffering caused by the mass migration across the Med? Mattia Toaldo is still with me in the briefing room, and joining us down the line from Brussels is Elizabeth Collett, Director of Migration Policy Institute Europe, whose job is to come up with solutions and advice for politicians on how to tackle migration. Mattia Toaldo, you actually have an idea, don't you, for how this problem should be dealt with. What is it?
So what I'm proposing is that Italy and the coalition of European countries negotiates with countries of origin and says from that day on, all irregular migrants who arrive in Europe will be returned to the home countries. In exchange for that, and as a guarantee that the system will work, we will give those countries some work visas. The message we will give to people is, if you come here irregularly, there is no space for you. But here is another system to come to Europe because we actually need you to do a certain number of jobs.
Tell me, would it be part of your plan that the numbers of visas you would issue would be roughly similar to the numbers of people currently coming illegally?
No, I don't think it would be acceptable for European public opinion just to swap irregular migrants for regular migrants. So my suggestion is that we take the numbers of 2016, we cut them by 3/4, and that's the number of work visas we issue.
So you issue roughly 1/4 of the work visas of the number of people who actually come illegally at the moment?
Exactly. Which doesn't mean that you would need to return all the other three-fourths. What happened in the EU-Turkey deal is that you set a date by which all irregular migrants will be returned. And after the first people are returned, then the other people will decide that it's not worth leaving because they know that they will be returned.
Okay. Elizabeth Collett, what's your reaction to that plan? Is it something that the European Union are discussing at the moment?
It's not just a case that the European Commission has been working on this for 2 years. It's been working on this for nearly 15 years and possibly further back. It's tried to create readmission agreements with a number of different countries. And I think it's important to note that the idea of offering legal channels of entry is something that has been used in various different ways over the last 15 years. The questions we have to ask are, why haven't these been successful so far? And who has been successful? There are a number of successful bilateral relations that the EU member states have with particular countries on a bilateral level, and the UK is one of those countries. And they're based on very thick relationships. They're not predicated on one thing, such as a work visa, but a thick relationship that brings in a lot of different interests, from trade interests to cooperation on particular areas and other policy portfolios that are not related to migration.
What would be examples?
A good example is the UK relationship with Nigeria. They have a broad dialogue with Nigeria that incorporates things such as return of seized assets to Nigeria, cooperation on outer space technology, thinking through trade incentives and various economic conversations, thinking about security issues and how they might cooperate more deeply. And so returns becomes a less difficult conversation because it's interwoven within a broad range of mutual interests.
Sorry, are you saying that the Nigerians are more likely to allow us to return people to them because we deal with them over space?
We deal with them on a broad range of issues. I'm giving the space example as a slightly extreme version of that. But you see this with the more successful relationships. It's about 10 or 15 different issues, of which return is just one. Which means if something goes wrong in the relationship or one part of that conversation isn't working well, the entire relationship isn't so fragile and won't break so immediately.
Isn't it just the case that the attractiveness of countries such as the European countries will, whatever we do, prove too great for people to resist in the modern era?
I want to come back to this idea that offering work visas would be a way of countering the attractiveness of using illegal facilitators of migration. There is very little evidence that the people who would be most likely to get work visas to the European Union, and the European Union focuses most on skilled and high-skilled people rather than those with very little education and very low rates of literacy. These people have been historically very difficult to integrate into the European Union labour market and society, that population are the population that are using the services of smugglers. Would this population necessarily overlap? We don't have any evidence on this, but I think our indications are that the profile of those who are choosing to use the services of smugglers don't necessarily match the profile of those who would be most likely to be able to take advantage of work visas.
So if there was a Collett plan, Elizabeth Collett, what would it be?
From my perspective, you have to look end to end at the entire immigration system. We have to look at creating economic opportunities in third countries. And we also have to start investing a lot more in what we understand we'll need in the European Union in terms of future labour market demands, but future societal demands. Because public concern about immigration is, as Mattia said rightly, about the chaos and the uncertainty and what comes next is really unsettling publics across the European Union. They see people in destitute situations and they wonder, well, hang on, are we in a position to be able to manage the full process of migration, including that long-term integration process? So we have to think about all of these different things together, which is why people like I have a job.
Well, the conclusion must surely be that the problem of mass economic migration is complex and its origins often unexpected. It is subject to no one big solution, but to a matrix of inducements, penalties and relationships, which will take some time to create. Well, that's it from the briefing room. My thanks to Joel Millman, Tuesday Reitano, Mattia Tualdo and Elizabeth Collett. And that's all from the briefing room this week. We'll be back next Thursday at 8 p.m. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Phoebe Keane. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.